Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Matt from A Few Good Men in Stroudsburg, PA.
Good evening. I like this water down here. Hey everybody, my name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. Terry, thanks for asking me to be here tonight. I'm a little nervous, which is interesting because I stand up in front of people and talk every day of the week. I think it's because today actually I have to talk about myself. And so Matt, I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober. My anniversary date's October 29th, 2013. Very, very grateful that I've not only been able to get sober, but stay sober. Because I have a long and storied career of getting sober. I do not have a whole lot of experience other than what I'm working with right now in terms of staying sober. I was talking to Terry a little bit before we came here, and I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting probably somewhere around 1999. I was a young guy, you know, 18, 19 years old, and even at that point in my life, the way that I drank looked much different than even from the perspective of, we won't call them alcoholics, we'll go with them as hard drinkers. Even from their perspective, the way that I drank looked different. And even to my father, it was noticeable. And so I was on the radar. And I have just about any chemical that you can think of that's been salt and peppered into my story over the years. Alcohol was my first true love. I have a long and storied career of relapse. And every time there was a relapse in my life, alcohol was the first thing that always brought me back. It's still to this day the thing that talks to me the most. My experience with all the other chemicals that I've used over the years, I've never found myself, minus maybe some cocaine from time to time, but the romanticizing of the alcohol is still something for me that is very real to this day. If I'm completely honest, I would have to say that there still is a part of me that wishes that I could drink. I've gotten far enough away from it that I don't suffer from the fear of missing out from it anymore. But there still can be this chirp in my mind that wouldn't that be nice, or this might be better if, and those thoughts still very much zip into my mind, and still to this day, one of the things that I know about myself is one of the worst things I can do to myself is sit in a room with other people that are drinking for any shorter extended period of time and watch other people enjoy themselves with alcohol. It's something that still affects me. And it's something that early on, if you said after a period of time that if, you know, you get to a place and you would have to stop talking about that, this is kind of what one of those things that I would say that it would be. But it's still very much there for me. I can romanticize alcohol still to this day. And so I've looked at this, you know, one of the things that has helped keep me sober today is I know that I can relapse. I've proven it to myself time and time again. And still and I want to be able to talk about practicing the steps rather than doing the steps as I share today, because for me, that's what I've found to be extremely important, is practicing, you know, AA says practice these principles in all your affairs. And so one of the things that was extremely important for me was to identify what those principles were. Because I would sit in meetings a lot and they would say, you got to do the work, you got to do the work, you got to do the work. And I've struggled with insecurities my entire life. And so I never wanted to be the guy that raised his hand and asked the question. I sit in all these meetings, but I don't understand what the work is. The book, right? Shouldn't the big book have a list of things that, right, you need to do and questions to answer? And people would say, what's the steps? It's the steps. And I didn't understand what that meant until some people really showed me. It was very experiential for me. And Rick, we were talking about Rick earlier. He was a gentleman that I got connected with very early on, Rick H. And I really struggled with God. And, you know, I got to find God. I went through that whole thing. And I remember him stopping me and he just cut me off. He said, Matt, once you get connected with the right people, you don't need to find God. He said, you get to experience it. And that turned into what it turned into. Well, I'll never forget him saying that. Thoma Lutheran Church sitting in the upstairs room. So I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. My father worked on a turnpike and was a bluegrass musician. My mom was a social worker in the Harrisburg Housing Projects. And when I was born, stopped working. So she stayed home with me. When I was about two and a half, my sister was born. And we were talking about camping earlier a little bit, right? And that was all of our vacation. That's what I did growing up. We camped. Went to bluegrass festivals, back of the pickup truck. At one point, we had a little Shasta trailer. But all my dad's buddies, including him, they were hard-drinking bluegrass musicians. So that's what we did. And I grew up in an environment where drinking and drinking to excess was acceptable behavior, right? I'd seen drunk adults most of my life. And as soon as I was able to kind of walk and carry things, I was trained how to pump the keg and fill beers and bring them to the guys as they sat around the campfire and played music. And so, you know, at a very young age, I would even have my little huggy in a koozie because that's what everybody else was doing. And so alcohol was part of the lifestyle for me even growing up. And, I started drinking at a fairly young age. I was a teenager. I was a daily drinker by 16 years old, and I was using cocaine daily at about 16 years old. I was a tiny guy growing up, and every nickname that I ever had to do with my size, right? It was Lil Matt or Delpy or Lil Delpy, right? It was always about how small I was. And so I was never as big. I was never as fast. I never thought I was strong enough. I was too small to play football. I was too slow to play soccer. I was left-handed. I got hit by the pitch all the time. I was scared of the ball, right? I wasn't a good baseball player. Tried to skateboard a little bit at one point, and I would say that's probably the thing that I got maybe the best at. But I was inconsistent with just about everything I did. I always wanted to be good at stuff, never really wanted to practice. Same with my guitar playing. My dad's a phenomenal guitar player. I always wanted to be a guitar player. Can't sing. Played some punk bands, but I'm a mediocre at best guitar player. And as a teenager, living in Harrisburg, one of the things that I was able to do was drink more than the older guys or drink more than the bigger guys. When most people could drink one 40 ounce of beer, Matt could drink two. If you could do one of these, I could do two. And I liked the attention that it brought me. Even later in life, even some of the negative attention that it brought me, I just enjoyed the attention. I enjoyed being talked about. I wanted to be the center of this. I wanted to be the center of that. I wanted to feel important. And when it was a real win for me, because not only did I like the way that it made me feel, I liked the attention that it brought me. And so alcohol really kind of became early on a centerpiece of my life. And you know, we'd go down to bars in the city, and nobody else would have the courage or the audacity maybe to go up to some of these older guys that were hanging out front of the bar and get them to go buy 40s and bring them out to us. And so that's what I became. And I liked the idea also of being needed. These guys, not only do I have this, but people want me around because I can get this for them. And that would manifest itself in a lot of different ways as I got older in terms of drugs and the lifestyle that I ended up getting pulled into. And it was just one thing after the next. I have a long and storied career with the criminal justice system, in and out. Drugs, drug possession, distribution, DUIs. That was the world that I got pulled into. And again, I liked the attention that it brought me. I learned later on, especially this last time when I was in the early stages of getting sober, that I was just as much addicted to the lifestyle of the disease as I was to the chemicals themselves. And it was really hard for me to break that, because my entire identity was wrapped up in that world. Won't get into all the lows, right, in terms of active addiction, because we know what that looks like. And by the end, I was unemployable. I had no home. I had no place to stay. I had no money, and I had no people. I can remember this last time I ended up in treatment. And then I ended up in Transitions, right, which is the aftercare program that I showed up at. And one of like the big things when you got to the halfway house was, or the sober house, was like after a period of time, you were able to get your telephone. Like that was like a big deal. We were very excited about that. Well, most of the group was very excited about that. I didn't have a phone. and nobody was giving me a phone. And when I finally got a prepaid whatever I got, one of the things that was very heartbreaking was I didn't have anybody to call either. And you know, addiction in and of itself, alcoholism is it's a very isolating illness. And even in a recovery house with whatever it was, between 15 and 18 other guys, I felt very alone. I've learned over the years that connection is not situational. It's a practice, and you learn how to do that, because one of the things that I've realized is I can isolate and feel alone in a room full of people. And so connection is not situational for me. It was a skill, I guess, through vulnerability, that I learned how to do that. And what I've learned now is I've been able to move and be different places and do different things. And because I have that, I get to take my ability to connect with me wherever I go. Evidence kind of even just by being here tonight and being able to have this conversation over here. That felt very natural, right? Where that would have been terrifying not that long ago. Who's going to be there? What am I going to say? What am I going to talk about? What are they going to ask me? Are they going to try to ask me too much personal stuff about myself? What am I going to have to say? How am I going to avoid questions? And then I would always find myself in a position where I would start to lie. And I lied all the time most of my life. And it became very common for me to lie. And that was the joke. You know, I would tell you that I had a sandwich for lunch if I really had soup. Just a lie, right? Didn't even really mean anything. But I would tell you about the sandwich. I would have details about it. I would talk about it. I just lied. I was a liar, pathologically, right, is what I thought. And what was that anybody ever gonna want from me? Or why would anybody like me? You know, I guess deep down in the core, the thing that I ultimately feared the most was I had to put on this front, or I had to put on this mask. I needed to be able to try to control what you thought about me. Because at the core of that for me, the fear probably was, if you saw me for how I saw myself, then I ran the risk of you rejecting me just as I've already rejected myself. And that probably wasn't even a fear. That was terror. I mean, that was a terror. I was horrified of that. And so I always had to do these different things so I could try to control what you believed about me. Fortunately, I was in a place that wasn't really going to let me get away with that for very long. And I can remember being at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting with the recovery house, and celebrating anniversaries, and I raised my hand. I celebrated 60 days sober. And so, you know, they all clap, and you get a key tag, and everybody wants to give you a hug. And they did their anniversaries at the end of that meeting, near the end. And I remember sitting at the tables on the left side of that room, and I had a key tag in my hand, 60 days. I think they say clean and serene for 60 days. And it was the first time since I had been sober that I started to cry. I started to cry really bad. And people kept coming up to me and like hugging me and telling me they were so proud of me. And I think that initially they thought I was crying because I was grateful. And I was crying because I was 30 whatever years old and had just been handed a key tag and I didn't have any keys. Like it broke my heart. Like I'm even emotional right now thinking about that moment. That everything that I had ever done, and this was everything that I had ever done in my entire life had brought me to a moment that I was getting hugged by strangers. I was handed a piece of plastic to put keys on, and I didn't have a single key in my life to put on that keychain. And I was just broken. I mean, I was told that everybody has a physical bottom. And what this, you know, your physical bottoms will change. And there will be an emotional bottom that you must hit in order for you to be able to see the true gravity of what this disease has taken from you. And everybody's physical bottom will vary. But when you come to this place in terms of an emotional bottom and you're able to allow yourself or give yourself permission to feel that, that's the piece that a lot of us have in common, is that emotional bottom. And that's why I've always liked that the ocean liner story in the Big Book. You know, from steerage to captain's table, right? All walks of life. But when the ship is sinking, everybody's in the same boat, right? And then they're all in the water. And they find themselves on shore. And, you know, they're hugging and they talk about the joyousness of that. And the thing that has brought that entire group together from steerage to captain's table has been the tragedy. And the tragedy has now brought this group together. And then as that story goes, then when they're done there, then everybody goes their separate ways. And what I've found interesting about recovery and being connected with the recovery community is that our pain is initially what has brought us all together. The tragedy of alcoholism is, I'm making an assumption here, but on some level, why we're all in this room. But there's this recovery piece that comes after that. And that's the piece that's able to keep us connected. Because if pain was the only thing that we ever connected on long term, this would be a pretty miserable group to be a part of, right? But initially, see, that's what brings us initially together. I think that's pretty powerful. Like that's the one thing that everybody in this group consistently can say that we're all good at on some level, is dealing with the pain that's created by alcoholism. And now the recovery piece is what will allow us to move forward. And that was I don't know when that started to formulate for me, but it was shortly after my moment with the key tag. I can remember the gentleman that ran the program saying something to me along the lines of welcome back to the human race, or welcome back to being part of humanity or something, because I'd actually allowed myself to cry. And once I kind of opened that up, it gave me the opportunity to continue to grow, I think would be the way to put that. There was a lot of hills and there was a lot of valleys in that, because I was not a big fan of going to AA meetings. I went there because I had to go. I thought they were pretty corny. I thought they were somewhat ridiculous. I didn't understand a lot what people were talking about. I felt different. I was very insecure. I felt like I wasn't smart enough. I would sit in the meeting, and if they were reading out of the Big Book, I would count the number of people before it would come to me and try to guess what paragraph would be mine to read so I could read it over and over and over again to make sure I knew all the words, because I didn't have, I'd gone to high school, but I didn't have any education, and I thought everybody was smarter than me, so I had to make sure that when I read out loud in a meeting, I wasn't going to sound stupid, because that would be the worst possible thing that could ever happen to me. And you know how that goes. Maybe 1 out of 10 times I would actually be on the right paragraph, and then I'd get one. Big Book's all got all kinds of goofy language in it, right? And I didn't know this is old timey stuff, and I couldn't pronounce this, and I couldn't pronounce that. And I would get beat red, and I would stutter. And I hated it. I think I can honestly say that I hated it. I didn't want to have to believe or accept that this was where I belonged. Because if I did, then what would that say about me, or what would that mean about me? I was in a lot of Big Book meetings. I was talking to Terry about that too. I like Big Book meetings. But the reason that I learned so much about the Big Book, and I was just, I'd kind of forgotten about this until I was talking to somebody about it at work. The reason I know so much about the Big Book is because I wanted to know what was in it so I could argue with you about it and show you how it was BS. I wanted to be able to pick it apart. I wanted to be able to shoot holes through it. I wanted to be able to argue with you about how what you believed and what you were saying was ridiculous in an attempt to allow me to look or feel superior in the moment. And so I figured if I'm going to get into an argument about something with somebody, I better at least know what I'm talking about, or I really run the risk of looking like an idiot. Long term, the way that's worked out for me is I know the Big Book really well. The motivation for me to know it early on was about being defiant and wanting to be argumentative. But again, most of when I look at what a lot of my defects of character are, and still can be, somebody said something to me about, I made the comment about, oh, that's old behavior. You know, you say something like that. Look, he said, how is it old behavior if you're still demonstrating it? He's taken aback. I guess I can't argue with that. And but my insecurities are still what drive a majority of those behaviors. I want to feel powerful. I want to feel in control. And I want to feel superior than you. And so what is it that I need to do to put that out there so you can have that vision of me? With that being said, I went to a lot of meetings. I went to all the events, the AAs, the dances, the EDIs, the Alcathons, the New Year's Eve thing. I mean, I didn't have a job, so I did AA stuff. And I stayed very, very busy. And I met a lot of people along the way. A lot of people that I was in the recovering community with. A lot of people, I ended up going to a recovery-based church. I stayed very, very active. And I got very, very close to a lot of individuals that I was in that process with. I was in sober living, I think, for 22 months. I spent 30 days in treatment. I was in a very structured sober living program for 9 months. And then I did another 10 months at like a step-down house. And I will say probably after about a year of that, I was internally motivated to continue to do that. The first 8, 9 absolutely had to do with the criminal justice system. I was in a lot of trouble when I got sober this time, and so I went with the lesser of two evils. But I made a lot of good connections with people. Moved into a place with a couple other guys that I'd gotten sober with. And here's where I really learned the value of the group, and here's where I really learned the value of honesty and accountability. When we talk about the steps. And I would sit in meetings all the time, and nobody, you know, in my mind, nobody ever would, what's the work? And I was fortunate enough that I got connected with some guys that really took me through the steps. And they made it tangible for me in the sense of, you know, I was like, all right, practical program of action and practice these principles in all your affairs. They were very repetitive with that. And so they would, they showed me, you know, you pull the steps apart. You know, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and that our life had become unmanageable. What's the principle that you need to be able to pull out of that? What's the principle that you need to have so you can practice the first step? They took me through this as if all steps were action steps, right? You know, I've heard like this step's an action step or that step's an action step. They're all action steps, Matt. It's all about a daily practice. And so they showed me, they said, you're going to need to be able to practice the principle of honesty in order to demonstrate the first step. Thought about that. I was like, all right, that makes sense. And so they go through them, and it was like honesty, hope, faith, courage, integrity, humility, surrender, willingness, forgiveness, perseverance, connection, and service, right? There was 12 spiritual principles that I could use to operate from. And they said, so if you look at your life in active addiction and how you behaved, but how you made decisions, how did you operate by those principles? And it was fairly easy for me to say that I was not. And they said, so bring those principles over here into a life in recovery and show me how you were bringing those principles into the decisions that you make and your relationships and your interactions with other people. And how is that working out for you? And so I haven't forgot that. I use that still today. You know, you talk about a daily inventory and looking at your day, because here's what I can say for myself today. When I don't operate with those, my results are different. And sometimes the result is what's going on here, especially with the honesty, courage, and integrity piece. Because I've still made a lot of fear-based decisions since I've gotten sober. And just I can feel it, right? Even when you look at it. And so I was living with these guys for quite some time. Yeah, the one guy got a girlfriend and he moved out. Somebody else moved in. But there was things that were in my... that I saw, things that I heard, that I knew weren't okay, right? And, you know, one of the things that I've experienced, I don't have any children, but even like with my mother, she would say things, she was like, how did I not see it, especially with me growing up? She's like, I guess I was just too close to it, I didn't see it. And I guess that's the value in denial. You know, the value in denial is that you don't have to look at the truth. I guess the lie with that could be the truth is too painful, right? Or I don't want to have to deal with that. And so, you know, we can reach for denial and it can allow me to operate in a place that's either not safe or not okay. It compromises my moral value system on some level, but I'll rationalize it, justify it, generalize it, minimize things to make it okay for me in the moment. And, you know, I've learned about the emotional bottom over and over and over again in recovery, and that idea that, you know, when your situation gets worse faster than you can lower your own standards, right, your emotional bottom will show up. And I can see this in hindsight in my experience, which what came in my recovery from, you know, 3 to 5 years. But in that period of time, I lost a lot of people. I lost a lot of people that were very, very close to me and very, very important to me. And it took my world and it flipped it on its head. The thing that probably scared me the most about it was... you know, I never knew how far away I was from picking up a drink. But I also didn't know how close I was to picking one up either. Because if you would have asked me in June of 2018, how everything was going in my world, I would have been able to tell you that everything was, you know, the people I'm with are connected, we're working recovery programs, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're doing this, we're doing that. And by the end of that year, four people that I was in constant connection with, that I'd lived with, I'd gotten sober with, we were close. I lost four people in a 6-week period of time to drug overdose and suicide. And everything that I knew about recovery, I thought was a lie. I thought everything maybe that I had been doing was a lie. I didn't know about the place for me in this world anymore, in terms of the recovery world. I was terrified and I was devastated. My roommate then started to drink again after the loss of our other roommate. I had to move. I lived in a guy's basement for 30 days. But here was the piece for me that I grabbed onto was a number of years ago, I was in tears because I didn't have any keys and I didn't have a phone. I didn't have anybody to call. My roommate died. My best friend at the time died of a drug overdose. My other roommate started to drink. My home was not a safe place for me to be. The recovery community had known in that area that Michael had passed, and they knew that Brian was drinking. And I was at Brian's house that night with him, Sandy, and Amy. Amy and I were not dating yet at the time, but from the time I left Brian's house to the time I got home to get some things together, either between text messages and phone calls or voicemails that I'd gotten, because I didn't get to all of them, I had seven different people offer me a place to stay. And that was a powerful moment for me, because there was a 2-week period of time there that I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what this is all about. I was like, maybe I need to move back to Harrisburg. I mean, you talk about distorted thinking, I was all over the place. But people from the program, they talk about showing up, and I guess the value in that for me is I always looked at people either as furniture or obstacles, right? There were things to get around or there were things to avoid. And I got into recovery and I started to be able to see myself included, but other people as human beings, which was a significant change for me. But one of the things that I would see all the time was, you know, people relapse and people go back out and people would use and people rush in and they help them and they save them. We get them clean back up and you get them back into either treatment or you get them back into meetings. And I saw a lot of that. So my thinking around the program was more that they'd be there to pick you up if you were down. And that was my first personal experience with the program, dealing with something that had affected me to that level, and people were there to actually catch me while I was falling. It was the first time I'd ever experienced anything like that, which was a powerful moment for me. The other thing that I can say about that period of time in my recovery is about 4 years sober, I'd gone back into group therapy. And so I was still in a group. I was still in group therapy at that time for myself, working on some anger stuff and working on some abuse stuff from when I was younger that I carried around for a long time, which ultimately played into a lot of me feeling the way that I felt about myself, because some things that happened to me when I was younger, and there was drugs and alcohol involved, and it was humiliating, right? I think that's the word that really fits. And so I was involved in that process when that took place too, which I believe was probably helped save me there too a little bit. It took me probably about a year to feel okay again. I had been working in drug and alcohol for a couple of years at that point, and all my insecurity stuff around that showed back up. How is the guy that runs a recovery program? What are people going to think about the guy that runs the recovery program that all his friends just died of drug overdoses? Right? People are going to think maybe I'm using. People are going to think that I've relapsed. People are going to think that I'm weak. People are going to think that I'm covering things up. All this, all my thinking, all that negative self-talk came back. And so all the ambivalence behind that too came. What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And I'm a runner. So you know, if the idea that I'm going to be humiliated, well, the only way that I can certainly avoid that is to completely remove myself from the situation. There were some very core people in my life at that point that kind of helped ground me. And I'm very grateful for that today. And it took me about a year, but I was able to work through that. Out of that, I met my wife. And I always thought marriage was a joke. I never understood why somebody would do that. It seemed like blah, blah, blah. I have a long story career about having lots of opinions about stuff that I don't really know a whole lot about. And marriage was another one of those. And Amy and I met, and you know, we dated for a while, and we have a lot of the same passions. She works in drug and alcohol as well. And so we had that in common. We had the conversation early on. We like each other, we'd like to have a relationship. Both of us were okay with not having children, so we got that one. We were both good there. And and that was something that happened. I've never been the beyond your wildest dream guy, right? I would hear that and I would roll my eyes. But when I think about experiences that I've had that I never thought that I would have, that was one of them. To be able to be with somebody in a relationship like that, where it wasn't a battle and it wasn't transactional. It was very foreign to me. I've heard enough of my story to know that relationships in my life probably I struggled with. And so the other part of it was for me, and I needed to do some work around this too, was all my I'm not good enough stuff then showed up again, right? I'm not smart enough. I'm not educated enough. I don't make enough money. I'm not good looking enough. I'm not thin enough. You know, I'm bald, right? Like things that it just all started to come back up. And I start to pull away. When discomfort for me, when I'm uncomfortable, my initial go-to is not to grab the program and work through it. My automatic response is I must avoid this. I need to find a way to get what I want, but circumvent what's going on with me. And so here came those principles, and here came the work again to allow myself to work through what I needed to work through. And, you know, down the line, I got to propose, and I'm happy to say in November of last year, I got married. November 13th, 2022. And so that was a big deal for me. I liked having my family there. I liked having my friends there. I loved the fact that I was able to do that. You know, I have a was born in 81, so I'm 40. I had to do the, I'm 42. And, you know, for an IV drug user like me, even when I was in treatment, one of the things that I was told was I needed to get sober and stay sober because there wasn't an old folks home for heroin addicts. I remember one of the counselors in treatment telling me that. He said, he said, you're a dinosaur in this game. I was like 30-something years old, right? I'm like, a dinosaur. And that was even before all the fentanyl stuff happened. But I never thought that I was going to be even be 40 years old. And so to be able to be, to get there and, you know, have some of the things that I have today and then be able to have my family back and have friends and be able to have a wedding and marry the person that I'd fallen in love with, for me was pretty exciting. And a number of years ago, that would have been something, I think the word that the big book uses is scoff, right? Scoff at things. I'd have scoffed at that, right? Sappy, lovey. But then there I was, you know, crying and hugging people. I spent 8 years in Berks County after I'd gotten sober. And we moved to the Poconos, right? And so I'm in the Poconos now. And Amy moved up here, up to the Poconos before I did. And I came up here. I've been up in the Poconos now for a little over 2 years. Terror came back in my life at that period of time. I'd never stayed sober before. I think the longest amount of recovery that I had ever had prior to this year was about 11 months. I was in and out of treatment, detoxes, but you know, I put together 11 months somewhere back in 2004, maybe 03 to 04. So it was even a while ago. And I was very comfortable in Berks County. I knew a lot of people. I knew where to go. I knew how to get to meetings. I could get around without my GPS, right? I knew it was my home. It was my new home. And now the conversations are starting to happen that we, in order for us, you know, this was going to happen, right? We were moving. And terrified, once again. I got to leave all my people. Am I going to be able to stay sober? I'm going to have to go to different meetings. It's going to be uncomfortable. I'm going to have to meet new people. I'm going to have to get a new job. I'm going to have to work someplace else. What are they going to think about me? They're going to think that I'm not smart enough. They're going to think that I'm not good enough. They're not going to accept me. They're not going to like me. So how am I, you know, in my mind now, how am I going to set myself up, right? How do I need to sound? How do I need to look? How do I need to present myself? And I automatically start to avoid the authenticity piece, right? Because my thinking is telling me now once again that nobody's going to accept me for who I really am, right? I need to create a version of myself to make me palatable for a new group of people out here. So, you know, once again, I'm projecting all my own insecurities on everybody that I'm about to meet. I have no idea what this is going to be. And so to be honest, so I got up here and I say up here, I'm not in the Poconos. I got to the Poconos and I will say that in terms of my recovery program, it stopped. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped talking to people. I even started to avoid people from home. It just became about me and work, right? What do I need to do? What do I need to do? What do I need to do? And I didn't have a ton of work even in that moment to keep me all that busy. I got tasked with starting a transportation department. Okay. So I was able to do that and I hired some guys, right? Hired a bunch of guys in recovery. And so we sit around and we're talking about recovery. And honestly, what got me back into the game was one of the gentlemen that I hired His name's Gene. Gene just celebrated 36 years. And Gene was up every week. When are you going to the meeting? When are you going to the meeting? When are you going to the meeting? I mean, he was relentless. And it was 8-9 months before I finally went back to a meeting with him. And then there were some other guys that I worked with, and they would got me to this meeting, and they got me to that meeting, and they got me to this meeting. And I had all the, not all, but I had a lot of the same stuff in those moments that I did back here. I'm not like these people. I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to sound stupid. The recovery that we had there is different than here. I mean, you name it. I came up with all kinds of reasons on why I needed to keep my mouth shut and why I needed to not participate in a recovery program. If I can almost guarantee that if a year ago you would have asked me to come here and speak, I'd have come up with an excuse on why I couldn't come on a Monday night, probably. COVID didn't help me through that because I got out of practice of going to inpatient meetings. And I did the Zoom thing a little bit here, a little bit there. I got pretty inconsistent. And I can absolutely promise you that I can remember sitting. This was the moment. I was sitting at the kitchen table in Wernersville at our house, and I had, it was the Wednesday night big book meeting. I had chaired it. I'd spoke on whatever I spoke on. I had opened the meeting up then at the end for people to share, right? And nobody shared. Smack the microphone. Nobody shared after I got done sharing. And I remember closing the laptop when I was done. And I was like, I don't need to do this anymore. This is a waste of time. I guess it was my own, like, you guys listen to me talk for 35 minutes about this, and you have nothing to say back, right? I've taken time out of my day to participate, and you're in there and talk and share about this stuff on the book, and now you're just going to stare at me. I'm very indignant. Right, very self-righteous, and I can look at that now. And part of that was a true disconnection from the program, even at that point, being a year or so into that, not having the day-to-day, the interaction with other people. My interaction was either at home with Amy or with the people at work. But this the fellowship piece, the face-to-face fellowship piece for me was done, right? Because COVID had taken that away, and I convinced myself at that kitchen table that I did not need to go to meetings anymore. And I stopped. And I came up with all the different reasons and justifications why it was okay for me to do that, right? I read, I talk about this stuff. I watch these different videos on YouTube that are very, whatever I came up with. I'm learning about this, I'm learning about that. I just continued to justify all the different things on why I didn't need to do right what everybody else was doing. And I know I became extremely challenging to live with. My anger came back. My self-righteousness comes back. It's not that I don't have a fuse, but I got a short fuse. But self-righteous and the anger is what comes back. You know, when I look at my own process, and these are even my tells today, is look, I still like to be the guy, I still like to be sometimes the center of attention. And so my cynicism is a lot of times is very much right there. I've learned enough about anger and signs of hidden anger, to know that sarcasm and cynicism are just, they're versions of anger on some level. But my cynicism is always right there. My cynicism for me is not always, see, I'm okay with it, right? Because it's funny, I get a laugh out of somebody, it's the joke. But if I'm not careful with my cynicism, right, it moves me into a place of being judgmental. It's a pattern for me. And I can be okay sometimes, even with my judgment. Because again, it's a way for me to feel superior. It's a way for me to feel better than. And so, you know, my sarcasm, my cynicism will take me to a place of sometimes very judgmental. And once I cross the line there, now I move into this self-righteous place. And I got taught early on that until you're offended by your own behavior, it will not change. And I hate the self-righteous piece. I don't like self-righteous people. I feel embarrassed and humiliated when I act out, when I find myself in a very self-righteous place. But I lived there for a while when I had really disconnected myself from what it truly means to work a recovery program. The true connection with other people that are working on the same stuff. And it was a painful process for me at, you know, 7-8 years to kind of bring myself back into it, because part of it was I didn't, just even 10 years ago, I didn't want to have to admit that I belonged here. And now after a period of time, I didn't want to have to admit that I still needed it. I wanted to be better than this, or I wanted to outgrow that, or I didn't want to have to, I think it was, I really didn't want to have to admit that I still needed to have support. I still needed a place to put it. I still needed a place for people to be able to understand that, look, I don't know what anybody thought of me when I started an hour ago and I said, there's a part of me that wishes that I could still drink, right? I don't know what anybody thought when I said that. I just know that I needed to say it. And that's the honesty piece for me. That was something that I learned. That's the piece that I was always afraid of. If I'm honest with you about what I'm really experiencing or what I'm really thinking, then you are going to judge me. And if you, what are you going to think about me? But what I've realized is I have no control over what somebody else thinks about me. What I do have control on is what I'm willing to share with you. And if me sharing with you in terms of me being honest is that, there's a part of me that wishes that I could still drink, then I'm going to say that today. I truly believe for me to accept myself as an alcoholic means that every single day I wake up, drinking is on my to-do list. It's, in terms of working a recovery program, I guess I've really kind of boiled it down to what is it that I need to do today to give myself the least amount of opportunity of checking that thing off the list. But my history has shown me that every single day drinking is on my to-do list. I think that's what it means for at least Matt here to be an alcoholic. And so how do I set myself up to not pick up that drink? And I think that's the piece that I needed to be reminded of on, at the end of the day, what is the primary purpose for an AA meeting for me? It's to not pick up a drink today, right? That's... And so what is it that I need to say? What is it that I need to do to help me not pick up that drink? I think that's the honesty piece for me. That's the courage piece for me. That's about integrity. That's about willingness. That's about humility, right? It's about connection. It's about service, you know. And the service piece for me came from the other way. Because there's a couple men that I can think about that I would sit in an AA meeting and I would hear them talk about thinking about a drink or wanting to drink, or, and, you know, people that I liked, people that I respected, people that had some time, and the courage that it took, I guess, or I'm assuming that it took for them to do that was an act of service, because on some level they've now given me permission to be able to do it too. I'm not scared about the thought of wanting to drink. I am scared about how that thought will manifest itself in my life if I don't talk about it. I believe the thought for me is what is powerless. There's a powerlessness for that for me today that I still experience. What I have some control over today is what I do with it. And my goal today is just to leave it on the field. And so I thank you guys for asking me to be here tonight. I haven't spoke my own story in some time, and I tell you what, it was good for me. It's good to hear it, it's good to say it out loud. And so I think what I want to say is thanks for listening.